This evening we learned the sad news of the death of the Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts at the age of 80, as you've heard there on the North. Charlie marked his 80th birthday in June and has been a member of the Stones since 1963. Earlier this month it was announced that Watts was to miss the band's forthcoming US tour. I'm joined now by Paul Muldoon to recall the life and career of Charlie Watts. Paul, can you put it into context, the importance of Charlie Watts and his place in the Rolling Stones?
Well, good evening, Kay. They don't get much bigger than the Stones, in fairness, and to have been a lifelong member of you know, a band of that stature automatically, I think, entitles you to legendary status. I think his loss is more keenly felt for his just the sense that there was a huge degree of affection, admiration, and respect for Charlie Watts, not just from the musical community, if you like, but also just in a wider sense. I think more than many drummers, he was a very iconic presence in the band that he played with. Drummers aren't always that. They're often kind of the guy at the back who people don't pay an awful lot of attention to. But now and again, a drummer comes along who is very, very much part of the look of the band, is very much the soul of the band. And of course, in the case of Charlie Watts, he was absolutely central to how that band sounded and how they kind of how they worked. It was all very, very much down to him. So I think it's a big, big loss. It's a big deal losing one of the Rolling Stones. And of course, you know, these mortal gods that we've made in rock and roll down through the decades, they are none of them, of course, immortal. And we've lost another one today, but I think it's a particularly keenly felt loss. I think there's a lot of very, very sad people, certainly members of my band, The Undertones, and other people that have been speaking to since the news broke. Pat Carty, who's a frequent contributor to this program, of course, I know for a fact he's very upset and is just beginning to put together his thoughts on it for Hot Press.
And, yes, we were only talking about the sister band, yeah, the Beatles, last night. We'll dig down into what he brought to the Rolling Stones in a moment, but Keith Richards, talking about Charlie Watts in 2003, said how he was one of the greatest drummers in the world.
I mean, I've been playing with the Cat for 40 years now. I mean, I'm the most blessed man in the world. I mean, the first drummer I ever really worked with was Charlie Watts, and I'm still working with him, and it's a constant source of enjoyment. Sometimes up there, we try and screw each other up. Yeah, I'll cut the beat up a little bit, but he'll trip me back. Boom! You know, this little games. You know, we don't really mean to do that, but sometimes, you know, you get like mischievous and do that kind of thing. And I mean, Charlie, if I can flip the beat for a moment, he'll catch it back and like lay it back on me. And I'm like, yeah, all right, cool, man. But it's a lot of it's experience, but at the same time, Charlie Watts, he's one of the greatest drummers in the damn world is ever going to see.
There, Keith Richards talking back in 2003 about Charlie Watts and about the fun they had. I'm talking to Paul McLoone about the death of Charlie Watts. The fun they had in the Stones, but it wasn't so all fun and games between himself and Mick Jagger, was it?
Well, I think every drummer will get, there'll be moments between drummers and lead singers. I certainly have been in my experience, and I think it's just there. Sometimes there can be a bit of a clash of personalities. There's a famous story that Jagger reportedly, now this story has been going around for years, to what extent it's really 100% true, I'm not sure. Maybe it is. But reportedly, Jagger, under the influence of a bit of booze, rang Charlie's hotel room in the middle of the night, inquiring after the whereabouts of, and I quote, my drummer. And the legend has it that Charlie got up, got dressed. He was always impeccably dressed, of course, a famously dapper man, always looking sharp. And apparently Charlie got up. Some reports suggest that he actually shaved, got dressed, went downstairs to the hotel lobby where Jagger had rung him from, and punched him in the face and knocked him on his ass, and basically said, don't ever call me your drummer. You're my, insert expletive, lead singer. So if that story is true, it kind of encapsulates maybe a bit of that sort of tension. I've always thought that Charlie, if you actually look at him when he's playing, he often seems to have that little wry smile on his face, just playing around the edges of his lips and occasionally one eyebrow kind of raised. And I like to think that sometimes he's just quietly amused at the antics of his flamboyant bandmates, Jagger, of course, And to no less an extent, Richards with the continuous shape throwing. But you got a sense from Richards' quote there of that interplay between him as guitarist and Richards is a unique guitarist as well. He's in terms of rhythm and the way he plays, he's instantly recognizable, and it's quite unorthodox in a way. And the relationship between him and Charlie Watts, that kind of interplay, that push pull between the two of them, is absolutely central to how the band actually sounds on record and indeed live. He's talking about the fun they would have just tripping each other up live. But that relationship is key in the sound of the Stones, that interrelationship between Watts on drums and Richards on guitar.
We have another clip now from Charlie Watts himself, who was interviewed in 2001 by Sue Lawley on Desert Island Discs on the occasion of his 60th birthday. She asked him at the beginning of the interview how he felt about getting old.
No, I'm quite comfortable with age, really. But lately it's sort of been a number, isn't it, to contend with.
60 is a big one, I suppose, isn't it? People used to worry about 40, but...
When we were getting to 40, yeah. No, it's never really bothered me to actually be 80 or whatever, but as it gets there, you suddenly, oh, God.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like you, really, does it?
Looking at the life I've led, very nice and very privileged, really. I mean, I get paid very well for doing what I love doing, you know? No, because I enjoy being with the Rolling Stones. The problem with the Rolling Stones is that they became so popular that you kind of saw them in the newspaper as opposed to how I knew them, you know.
But also, does it feel like something apart from you when you see all the publicity? It's not the people you know, is it?
What, them or it? What I mean is, Keith is a friend of mine, and that's one thing, but the Rolling Stones are a whole nother thing. I know it's as much him and me, but I've always kept it a long way away from me. A, because I never really believe it, or to be honest with you, and I feel happier that way. The Rolling Stones finish when the curtain closes.
Charlie Watts there, talking to Sue Lawley on Desert Island Discs in 2001. That was some job to try and separate yourself from the rock and roll lifestyle, especially when it's manifest by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, and yes, actually quite difficult, I would have thought, to sustain over that period of time. But he famously managed for the most part to do it. He would eschew the, shall we say, the occasional excesses that his bandmates may have enjoyed on the various tours. He didn't really get involved in any of that. And as he said himself there, you got a sense that he would do the show and then just quietly, you know, walk away from the whole kind of circus that goes with it. And I guess that's kind of evident in his temperament and his kind of attitude were always very... always very visible, I think. He did seem to just sit slightly apart from that. You could even tell by his kind of body language and his manner on stage that he was just there in a kind of a quiet but crucial sort of presence on stage. You could tell that the rest of the craziness wasn't really why he was there. He wasn't there for any of the other reasons.
Paul, you picked Get Off My Cloud to commemorate Charlie Watts. What is it about this song that shows Charlie's style so well?
Well, I think it's just, again, if you listen to the drumming, what he's doing is he's doing these drum rolls and he's playing this repetitive pattern that's actually, for the time, again, quite unorthodox and quite progressive. And Charlie's background, the other Stones and a lot of the musicians of his generation were rhythm and blues guys. And Charlie was a jazz guy. And I think that really, again, was another ingredient that kind of fed into that slightly unique feel that the Stones had, was the fact that he was coming off the back of a whole kind of jazz scene, whereas the others were more kind of blues, rhythm and blues. And I think Get Off My Cloud is just a great piece of original, inventive, creative drumming. And I think he kind of gets his own back a little bit as well, because obviously with the Stones, the songs were normally about Keith's riffs. And on this track, it's actually more Charlie that's come up with the riff. The riff is kind of the drumming. And I just think, as a tribute to him, it's an appropriate choice.
Get Off of My Cloud from the Rolling Stones. My thanks to Paul McLoone for his assessment of Charlie Watts, the late Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. Vigil is the new six-part drama from the producers of Line of Duty. The series begins on BBC One next Sunday and stars BAFTA-winning actress Suranne Jones, famed for her roles in Dr. Foster and Gentleman Jack. Vigil couldn't be further in setting from her previous dramas, set aboard a Trident nuclear submarine. Jones's character, Amy Silva, is a detective called in to investigate the mysterious death of a crew member. With us now to take a look at the opening installments is Etna Shortall. First of all, Etna, Vigil is the latest production courtesy of the team who brought us Line of Duty and Bodyguard. And though Line of Duty is limited to the mean streets of Belfast and Bodyguard at times found itself trapped on a train, setting a show under the waves in a submarine is quite a challenge.
Absolutely. And it's so original. Like, obviously, I had a brief idea of what it was about before I started watching it, but I was impressed and surprised by how much of it is actually set aboard this one specific submarine. And, you know, the submarine itself has this feeling of claustrophobia when you're watching it, and I presume when you're on board it as well. But they still, you know, you enjoy being in that world. And it's not a world I knew about, submarines. I mean, I actually sort of thought that they were a World War II Cold War phenomenon, and wasn't aware that the UK still has several of these ships with nuclear weapons aboard, you know, patrolling through its waters. And it does. And one of these is called Vigil. Well, in this show, it's called Vigil. And that's where the drama is set. But to kind of keep, you know, it has, as a setting, it has benefits because it gives you that Agatha Christie locked room type setting, because no one can get off, you know, without it, like without going above water, and no one can get on. So there's a murder on the boat, and you're like, well, it has to be someone on this boat did it, or at least one person did it, and we're going to find out who, and a detective is sent in. But it has limitations as well, of course, because you can't really vary the set. It's quite dark in tone, like visually dark to watch, and you know, like it's a sterile environment, and so a lot of the backdrops are very similar. But it's not all set aboard the ship. So as you said, Suranne Jones is playing the lead character, DCI Silva, but her police partner, Rose Leslie, who people will know from The Good Fight and Game of Thrones, she's back on land doing kind of complementary investigations into the two mysteries. I should say there's two. There's the murder of someone on board the submarine, and then there's the sudden sinking of a fishing trawler that was a mile from the submarine when it sunk in very mysterious circumstances.
Well, let's play a clip which introduces us to Amy Silva, played by Suranne Jones. Her superior, Robertson, played by Gary Lewis, introduces her to the Navy Admiral Shaw, played by Stephen Delan, in Glasgow, where she is briefed on the case that will see her spend 3 days on board HMS Vigil.
Rear Admiral Shaw, this is DCI Amy Silva. She's my best detective. I would even say that to her face.
Well, we'll get straight into it, if you don't mind.
I have charge of Britain's four Vanguard-class submarines. These are the ones with the nuclear deterrent. HMS Vigil is one of those boats. Earlier today, one of her crew died of a drugs overdose.
What kind of overdose?
They think he snorted heroin.
Snorted it? So is that misadventure or a deliberate overdose?
All we know is that he was found dead in his bunk. Unfortunately, this happened within British territorial waters, so we've had to bring it to you.
Yes, it's been the MOD versus Holyrood all evening, but the upshot is the usual rules apply. We have to look into it.
When's the submarine due back?
She's not coming back. At any given moment, one of these boats is out on active patrol, ready to fire within 15 minutes. It's been that way for over 50 years. We're not going to abandon it over one man's mistake and some bureaucratic bullshit.
So we have to send the detective out to join HMS Vigil.
Me?
You'll be on board for 3 days, finish your paperwork, then they'll let you off on a raft.
A raft?
Yes, it's perfectly safe. Unless you get hit by a tanker.
Suranne Jones there playing Amy Silva. And she is really set off on her own into this not totally male atmosphere, but this very cramped situation, which is the submarine. What does she meet? Does she meet resistance or does she meet cooperation?
No, an awful lot of resistance. So even before she arrives on the ship, you get the feeling that this is not, this is not a setting where you speak out or you go against what the superiors say. You know, there's a potential Band of Brothers type loyalty amongst the crew, but it feels like more than that, that there is a culture of fear and that you know, that you're afraid what will happen to you. I mean, someone's been murdered, so if you speak out, what will happen to you? So you fear for her going out to the boat, because 3 days and she has no way of getting off. She has no means of contacting the mainland. It's all very clever as a setting, because, you know, like with modern dramas, the problem is often with mobile phones that can solve everything. But she's not allowed to bring her SIM card. She can't contact them because that might let enemies or foreign nations know where exactly the submarine is located by sending out a signal. So she's all on her own. And you're thinking, oh, no, this isn't going to go well, because she's not getting cooperation. But it feels even slightly more sinister than that.
OK, let's listen to another clip. Here's Suranne Jones playing Amy Silva, is shown about the vigil by the crew member, Elliot Glover. And he's portrayed by Sean Evans.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to examine the body.
What? Well, follow me.
The ship have a doctor?
Oh, would you take that for me? Thank you. It's a boat. Submarine's always a boat. And yeah, we've medical officer, Lieutenant Doherty.
Well, can you have him come and assist me?
Our doctors are here. We're 8 women, 140 men. You can help to even things up, excuse me.
What's the bomb shop?
It's where we keep the torpedoes. Oh, you're
out.
You're not covered in bruises in the first week. You're not moving fast enough.
How big is this thing?
It's about the length of 2 football pitches and about as tall as 4 double-decker buses.
All right, I'm going to need a map.
Here, give me a bag. I'll take that.
Thanks.
No worries. This is the main event. You know what's in these?
£50 million worth of nuclear missiles.
That's the real reason there aren't many nuclear wars. Can't afford to replace these.
There you go again. So obviously she's not very, there isn't going to be an open flow of information from the crew members, because you say, as you describe so well, there's this Band of Brothers amerta amongst the members of the crew. And this is really because of the type of cargo they're carrying. What kind of information do we get on the Trident and the fact that they're carrying bombs?
Yeah, so they're like, again, this isn't something I knew about, and I'm sure a lot of other people did, and I'm sure in the UK, you know, it's very very commonly known. But so the British submarines have these nuclear weapons that they're constantly moving around their waters, ready to deploy should, you know, a foreign nation attack at any moment. So they have nuclear weapons and they have missiles on board, and so obviously that adds to the ominous tone. And you know, there's moments where there is faults that can't be explained with the submarine, and you think, well, like, if this explodes, I mean, not only would they be doomed, but presumably potentially the whole of, I don't know, the UK, Europe is gone. I mean, the stakes are high, very high. And it one of the great things about the drama is that it does teach, but you do kind of accidentally learn about the Trident nuclear program. And it's not just the ships and how they operate, although I have to say, I can't imagine the British Navy will be too happy with how they're portrayed in this. But it's also opposition to it in Scotland, which is where their Navy base is, and the world beyond that. But on land, we get to meet some of the protesters that object to these nuclear weapons and to the Trident programme in general.
Now, it's not all bombs and periscope up and periscope down. There are other, like, there is a personal story, particularly in the case of DCI Amy Silva. What do we know about her personal circumstances?
Yeah, so this is maybe more familiar from people that watch a lot of these dramas. It's given in flashbacks, you know, and so there's kind of a question posed at the beginning, because we see flashbacks to DCI Silva's life where she has a husband and a daughter. But then we see how she's living her current life, and the only person living with her is a cat. And so we get the flashbacks to them, and we know it will be revealed, which it is in the first 2 episodes, where they are, what happened to the husband and the daughter, and why it is that she's on her own now. And that the personal element sort of feeds into and hampers, in a way, her investigation. Because there's this huge feeling of claustrophobia on the boat, obviously, like they're sleeping in these tiny bunks that definitely give the impression of sleeping in a coffin. And then she has a trauma that she's dealing with, and you know, she's getting flashbacks and anxiety. So then we do start to feel for her as a person. And, you know, it just gives that extra depth. But definitely central to it is the two mysteries, the murder on board, who did it, and then what happened to this fishing trawler that sunk a mile away.
Yeah, and when people get to watch the first episode of this, they'll say, why didn't Etna Shorthall tell us this or that? There are so many spoiler warnings to go with. Vigil. So if we see actors and if we wonder why we weren't told things, it's because we don't want to spoil it. So let's get another clip instead. This is crew member Glover, who we met earlier, played by Sean Evans, has a word with the submarine captain Newsome, played by Patterson Joseph, about DCI Amy Silva's investigation.
Where is she now?
In the ladies' bunk.
What do you think of her?
She's clever. Once she starts talking to people, it'll be hard to keep her contained.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to keep her on a short lead. And, I can sit in on any interviews. It's not a bad idea. Mm. But, Coxon, I think, will let you cover that. So I really think it should be me who sits
there. Those are my orders, XO. And now I need a word with the coxswain.
Sir?
I've got to settle up with that prick for 3 days. You will keep an eye on her, won't you? We can't afford a scandal.
No, sir. We can't.
There's the captain and the chief petty officer unhappy that they have a DCI on board. Etna Shorthall has been looking at the new BBC One series Vigil. So it showcases the familiar themes and patterns a procedural crime drama offers, and the setting gives it a fresh new feel. What do you think of it overall? Are you invested, Etna?
I loved it. The atmosphere is great. Like, you hear from that clip, it's sort of chilling. Like, you're constantly double guessing, you know, who's a goodie, who's a baddie. Maybe they're all baddies, maybe they're all goodies. And, you know, I had that moment where I was shouting at the screen, trust nobody, which is just generally means I'm all in, you know. I believed it as a world. I've seen the first two episodes and I'll definitely watch the rest. And yeah, like you said, that ability to give people what they want, in that it's a 6-part drama. You know, there will be more twists, but they're not cheap. You'll be invested, it'll be solved in the end, and then to also have that fresh feeling to it, this whole new setting, this whole new world that you kind of learn about as you go. So yeah, no, definite recommendation from me.
Thank you very much, Etna Shorthall, and she's been speaking to us about Vigil, which starts on BBC One next Sunday at 9 p.m. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. 2 years ago, poet Stephen Sexton published a remarkable debut collection, If All the World and Love Were Young, an exploration of the world of Super Mario and the world of grief. Amid widespread critical acclaim, it won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection. Now he's back with a new book, Cheryl's Destinies, in which, among other things, activists liberate a zoo, and Billy Corgan, lead singer with the Smashing Pumpkins, has a conversation with W.B. Yeats. And in keeping with tradition, Cheryl's Destinies is shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Collection this time. I'm delighted to say that Stephen Sexton joins me now on the line. Stephen, you're very welcome back to Arena.
Good evening, Kay. Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with Arena, and you've been incredibly supportive of my work. So
yes,
thank you.
You are quite a regular and we're thrilled. Would you introduce us and read the poem My Second Favourite Locker Room Mystery, which really introduces us to Cheryl as well?
It does. So a strange poem. At some time in our lives, most of us fall in love in a bowling alley, I find. So this poem's no different. Let's see. My second favourite locked room mystery. Since I started working at the bowling alley, I think about it all the time. In his barn, from a high rafter or crossbeam. A man has hanged himself, with no ladder or platform to get him there, nothing suspicious, save a patch of damp on the straw-strewn dirt floor. Cheryl, on the other hand, is really into tarot. When the soda fountain's not so busy, she shuffles up my destiny, and every time seems to draw the lovers. Think about it, flashes the braces in her smile, and the pin setters chew like beautiful mouths. Thinking about the future always makes me so thirsty. So while Cheryl sorts out pin jams and inventories the shoes, I slurp a Coke with plenty of chipped ice. And before long, my head is full of icemen and their cold chariots, horse-drawn ice plows, the lakes of Massachusetts. When she's fed up with kismet, Cheryl lets me build little card castles. And I sometimes think I could marry her some hot day in the summer, an ice sculpture of a bowling pin undoing itself into a puddle of water at the highest of June. And I think of his horses. What were their names?
My second favourite, Locked Room Mystery, there by Stephen Sexton from his new collection. Stephen, that's a harrowing opening image. And then we go into this kind of cheerful meeting with Cheryl.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, this poem, like many poems, is entirely, a mystery to me. And it is. It's you know, this idea of, someone bored at work when they should be doing something else. I'm thinking about this sort of thought experiment, this mystery, and sort of never getting the answer to it. You know, it's sort of working away, trying to solve this sort of thought experiment and just never quite getting there. And then becoming this poem where they almost solve this mystery. But you know, meantime, are entirely distracted. Maybe it's a poem about attention spans, among other things.
Now, who is Cheryl? We meet her in some other poems, as well as my second favourite, Locked Room Mystery.
Okay, I wish I knew. It's been something that's been occupying me for some time. I mean, I think Cheryl is a couple of people. She is, first of all, a character in the purely literary sense, in that I was writing these poems with people in them. I mean, this is a little love poem, really. And it's always more satisfying, I think, if someone has a name rather than being he and she, for example. So on that hand, she has a name. She's merely a character. But I suppose what I've become really interested in lately is how time works. And this is by way of trying to understand who Cheryl is. I mean, we've been spending a long time moving through, as we call it, the decade of centenaries. And I always had this sense, you know, of time operating in this particular way, where every event, you know, of 100 years ago seemed to have its kind of psychic double event, you know, in its commemoration. And of course, lately, during lockdowns, our relationship with time has become stranger still. So Cheryl is someone who, as the poem suggests, is really into tarot, who knows something about time, knows something about how it works. And the way that tarot works, I thought, it's about interpreting things. It's about recognizing patterns, about basing images and, you know, language against one's own life. And it struck me, you know, that's really the same thing as what reading is, what a reader of a poem does. They make similar gestures towards interpretation, to identifying patterns, to thinking about things. So while Cheryl is very much a character in this book, who goes on to do a couple of different things, I think the best answer I can give you is, you are Cheryl. You're the reader of these poems. You're interpreting these things. You're trying to make sense of the present and the future by way of the past.
So speaking about looking back and looking forward and trying to make these connections, part two of the collection, Cheryl's Destinies, is a whole exploration of the past and the present. You bring W.B. Yeats together with Billy Corgan from The Smashing Pumpkins. Where did you conceive of this meeting?
Yeah, I did do that. I mean, really, this was, sitting around really at the very start of the lockdown, I guess, or when it was becoming very clear what was going to happen as well as we could understand it. And, you know, I guess it was becoming more and more obvious that we would be spending a lot of time, you know, in isolation, away from each other, away from society, but it would be kind of different. And, you know, out of mischief, I mean, which is a really key motivation for me, I sort of thought, well, if we can't with each other, you know, make these connections, if we can't have the kind of intimacy that we would usually have with each other in conversation in cafes and pubs and restaurants, if we can't do that, why not make somebody else, why not make two other people come into a kind of improbable relationship with each other? So it's mostly, I think, the impulse is this sense of trying to make connections while the rest of us kind of lose those connections, while they become fundamentally changed. And mostly the challenge of it, you know, could I make these two people talk to each other? But beyond that, I suppose the biggest thing is finding a way of recording this time. You know, these are two characters who I make speak to each other, who are both in a certain kind of isolation themselves. They're both trying to work with things. And of course, Yeats, as we know, was present during the last pandemic in 1918. And I think we, you know, when it's strange, I suppose, to think about, you know, the poems that come immediately after that, or the poems of the 1920s, that must have been absolutely been in the imagination, because we know that this doesn't just go away. You know, it isn't sort of kept within a single year. I mean, the memory of this will be with us for a long time. So it's thinking about all of these things, about how to create work in response to a kind of trauma like this, but mostly about, you know, creating this kind of intimacy, however, you know, improbable or unlikely. Why not make these people talk to each other when we are separated from each other as people?
And presumably you're a fan of both. And so did you see similarities or echoes in their writings?
I did, yes. I mean, I am a big fan of both of them in very different ways. I mean, they're both very passionate people, I think is safe to say. They're both quite romantic people. And a lot of their symbols are very similar. You know, there's a lot of roses, there's a lot of honey. There are bees, which of course we know from Yeats's Lake Isle of Innisfree. And I think there is a sort of similarity in some ways with their work, mostly in the level of symbol. Of course, they're both very interested in song, naturally. But I do feel as though there's a sympathy with the two of them.
Now, it's too long a poem to read the entirety of. So I thought I might ask you just to read another one instead. What about A Short History of Happiness? And could you introduce it for us?
Gladly, Kay. Thank you very much. Let me just have it here. So this is a poem that is again, you know, rather mysterious to me. Really, I think what it's thinking about is also thinking, you know, about a sense of history, but thinking about history as being not merely, you know, what we record it as, but necessarily history is also everything that didn't happen. You know, if there were two ways that time or circumstances could take any given event for it to happen or not to happen, it seems like it's appropriate that history is both of those things happening at once. In this case, you know, it's simply starting with a rather strange scene of a desert and moving very quickly to the present day to someone in an office. Yeah, very mysterious to me, I must say. A Short History of Happiness. In a red desert, someone's last pure thought invents the heaven she has no name for, the heaven we call a water tap, so unimaginable as to be beyond a miracle 50 generations away, 100, 1,000. And she passes uncredited, almost out of history, where history is what we call what might have happened differently and didn't, such as a good man's joy this spring morning, in his lovely office, polished free of breath and fingerprints, even his waste paper basket emptied somehow, where the magic amaryllis, despite his never watering it, shows new, majestic, red flowers.
A Short History of Happiness there, read by Stephen Sexton from his collection Cheryl's Destinies. There's an anxiety in this collection for young people and young men in particular, Stephen.
There is. I mean, and I think there's a lot of anxiety in the book, generally speaking, and partly that's, you know, I live in the north, and you know, Brexit has, as it's been for everyone, I think, a source of considerable anxiety, coming as it did, sort of part of the way through this decade of centenaries when we're remembering everything else. That's been a source of tremendous stress, I think, to many people. General developments, I think, in Western politics have been caused a lot of anxiety too. And I do worry about a lot of young men, especially young people, I should say generally, but there's a lot of young men in particular who I think are very easily seduced by certain kinds of politics, certain kinds of politics of violence and politics of power as well. And I worry about them because what the recent political developments in the West have been very good at doing, I think, is leveraging people's futures kind of against them. I mean, both Brexit and the former US president, they both made promises about the future, a concern about what this book is. I mean, those two movements only succeeded because they promised a certain version of the future. And I guess if you're disenfranchised, if you're a young person facing a lot of economic hardship or hardship with your, with finding somewhere to live, with employment, with everything like that, those things become particularly interesting, I think. And that kind of concerns me an awful lot, especially because all of that kind of rage, which is often accessed, usually it turns outwards and often it turns inwards too. So there's a lot of anxiety, I think, about that, about this sort of moment that we're in, what this generation, with all of its stresses, who those people will be when they grow up. So, yeah, I'm deeply concerned, I suppose, about those people.
So then, Stephen, maybe O Brother might be a good poem to finish with, if you wouldn't mind.
I will, very gladly. Thank you, Kay. And yes, I mean, not that it necessarily matters that this is somewhat of a true story, but I remember bumping into the same man in many different bus stations who always needed a few euros to get to the next one. It was a very strange thing to see him again. He didn't remember me. Yes, I think this is a poem that's both interested in language's ability to tell the truth, but also to deceive. Oh, brother, I'm some pigeon, made by the same man in shabby bus stations across the country, Cork and Letterkenny, Derry and Dublin, a few euros shy of the next departure. Wherever he's going, there's his brother, in bad shape after a road traffic collision, usually in A&E and unresponsive, often not expected to make it through the night. What can I do but hear him out? The cafe's closed today and forever. The coffee machine cappuccino is a consomme of dust and hard water. We're all past our glory. A busted brother in every other city summons someone to his deathbed to say sorry for some upping of anchor and drifting apart. But it's never abandonment. Not quite. Just times taking on a different music. Deltas, lemon groves, paddy fields, the world framed by the windows of high-speed trains. The second hand harries the hour hand. Buses glide like currency from the depot, where I fish in my pocket to offer this man my sympathies, my smithereens of pelvis.
O Brother, read there by Stephen Sexton, and Cheryl's Destinies is published by Penguin. It's just 10 to 8. Claire Louise Bennett is an English-born writer now based in Ireland. Her debut, Pond, a collection of surreal short stories, was shortlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize in 2016. Now she has published her first novel, Checkout 19. The checkout in question is in the supermarket where the book loving central character plied her trade while checking out Nietzsche on the side. It's a book full of imaginative takeoffs and a love affair with the written word. And its author, Claire Louise Bennett, joins me now. Claire Louise, Checkout 19 presents the reader with interwoven, overlapping stories, autofiction perhaps, streams of consciousness, definitely. How would you describe Checkout 19?
So Checkout 19 is my, well, I regard it as my second novel. My way of, I suppose, writing novels isn't particularly conventional, I suppose. But in my mind, Pond is a novel, and so is Check Out 19. And it's a variety of things, I suppose, because it's looking at a variety of different factors that impact upon a life. So it's looking at the imaginative realm and the lived realm and the social realm and the economic factors that also impact upon our lives. So there's quite a few different, I suppose, dimensions at work all within the same text.
So in Check Out 19, we follow the narrator from a young girl going to school, slowly discovering the power of reading and writing. Describe her to us.
So the situation really is she comes from a working class background. She's growing up in a town that's kind of prosperous. It's at a time when the UK joined the EU. So there's a lot of money going around and a lot of jobs are available, quite boring jobs. So she starts to understand as she gets older what adult life entails. And it doesn't look too appealing, to be honest. At the same time, she is developing a love of literature, which is opening up another sense of the world, a more expansive world, a richer scale of existence. So there's a kind of a tension between what's around her and what's available to her because of her class and what she is experiencing inside and what she is capable of herself.
Yes.
So this tension is there throughout the book.
Yes, because let's say in the classroom situation, she keeps a lot to herself when she's involved in a project with other girls. She knows she's a girl of ideas. She knows she's a person of ideas, but she chooses not to share them.
That's right. And interestingly, recently I was working on a documentary looking at other working class writers. More historically, well, 20th century. So, for example, I looked at Tove Ditlevsen and Annie Ernaux. Tove Ditlevsen is a Danish writer. She was born in, I think, 1917, working class family in Vesterbro, which was a very rough area in Copenhagen. And she describes in her own book, autobiographical book, the Copenhagen Trilogy, something similar, that she didn't feel really able to talk freely about what was going on in her mind and her love of words and what she was creating. And then also I found the same in Annie Ernaux, which I'm sure many listeners will be familiar with. She's been translated into English recently by Fitzcarraldo. Her work is fantastic and it was a huge influence for me, really. And she describes something similar, and there's a really moving scene where she talks about in her book, A Man's Place, she talks about returning from university to see her family, and they run a cafe, a pizzeria, very humble people, and she can't join in the conversation anymore, and she feels a bit awkward, and she just wants to go to a room and read Virginia Woolf and social theory. So you're having to keep a lot inside, you're having to keep quite a lot to yourself because you don't want people to think that you're getting ideas above yourself, and you don't want people to think that you're inadvertently judging them by doing so, you know. So it kind of generates this bizarre duality in you, which I think continues throughout your life to it in a way, you know.
It's also in school through her teacher, Mr. Burton, who she is, you know, very taken with, that it's through an accident that she discovers the power of writing. Could you just tell us the little story about the narrator and the teacher and the story he reads?
Well, she's written, in the back of her book during a lesson where he actually is absent because she's quite bored in his absence. There's a supply teacher and he's not too good. And she has, I guess, a certain attraction towards this teacher because I guess he represents for her the imagination and the possibility of other worlds and elsewhere. So she's kind of fixated on him. And then she's quite excited by the fact that this day he is not there because then she gets to imagine where he might be and the kind of person he might be in this other place. And that's something, I guess, that is something very exciting to consider just generally. I mean, we often see people in just one context and, you know, we tend to think that that's who they are. But people are different in different contexts, I suppose. So yeah, she writes a small story, and he discovers it later on. And he asks her if she has any more, and she says she doesn't. No, she says she does, even though she doesn't. Because then she just writes some more to give him, because she loves this idea of having this connection with him, and she likes the idea that he has these stories that are hers in his house, because it makes her feel like she somehow crossed over a boundary and that she's kind of with him outside of the classroom. So
yes, and the more profound point you make then is, here was a way of reaching someone, of being with them when you were not and never could be. In other words, that's the power of story, that you can so connect with them. And a whole theme within the book is that a story and words and books are never dead things. They're alive by the different way they're read by different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose that's a central theme, is it? There are sections of the book where you just luxuriate about, you know, a book, the physical thing of a book, and then about words on a page.
Well, it seems that the interpretation of it has been very much picking up on that aspect of it, but I think for me, writing it, a very strong element of it was to do with class, really, and who gets to write, and the difficulty, I think, of working in that vocation and developing that vocation and developing that talent. Like, a very big part of it is about the idea of promise and potential, and what it feels like to discover that you do have a talent and a gift and you do have promise. But what the hell use is that if you're in a situation where you can't do anything with it because you don't have the connections, you're in a working class world, you don't have any way of, no one values what you're doing around you, because it makes sense that they don't value it, really, because how are you going to make a living in this way? You know, that how can they encourage it? Because there's just no way you're going to be able to look after yourself. So one of the really main points of the book is just how difficult it is. And to be honest with you, I'm feeling it very much today because I've been evicted this afternoon. So
from
in
your
time,
your,
I won't have anywhere to live again.
From your house?
Yeah. So
you've
it goes
been evicted?
On. It goes on. I have been evicted, yeah. And it goes on and it goes on. So it's always a difficulty. Who gets to make art, and how can you keep doing it? You know, and increasingly in the society that we live in, it feels it doesn't really value. It values art, but it doesn't seem to value the people that make it.
Indeed.
That's how it feels to me at the moment.
Indeed, and I think so many artists, performing artists and artists like yourself, are suffering at the moment. Claire Louise Bennett, thank you so much. Checkout 19 is published by Jonathan Cape. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.